was in the history hallway, and as soon as we heard the alarms, everybody just, you know, started leaving, following the same procedure as we did, because nobody thought it would be this. Nobody thought it was a shooting. Everybody just thought it was a, you know, normal procedure, practice, fire drill. And next thing you know, we just hear so many, three gunshots, loud explosions, and all the teachers are telling us to run, run, go, like, run. Nobody should go through this. Nobody should be able to feel that in school. This is the place where we're supposed to feel safe. This is somewhere we come most of the week. Nobody should have to go through this. Nobody should feel that pain.
It's just heart-wrenching today. A student named Brianna in Santa Fe, Texas, speaking about the shooting at her high school earlier this morning. The suspect reported to be another student there named Demetrios Pagortsis. Witnesses say he was armed with an AR-15-style rifle, a pistol, and a shotgun. He and one other person are in custody right now, and the county sheriff is reporting 10 people killed, most of them students. There are reports of explosive devices, pipe bombs found on the campus and off the campus as well. Here's Santa Fe School District Police Chief Walter Braun.
There have been explosive devices found in the high school and surrounding areas adjacent to the high school. Because of the threat of these explosive items, community members should be on the lookout for any suspicious items and anything that looks out of place.
Matt Dempsey is on the line right now from Houston. He's the data editor over at the Houston Chronicle. And also from the Chronicle, Rob Dowen is there in Santa Fe on the ground. Thanks to you both for joining us on a very busy news day.
Thank you for having us.
Matt, I'm going to start with you. Could you take us through what happened this morning when those first shots were fired? A lot of students say they first thought it was a fire drill initially. Then some of them, like the one we just heard, ran off campus for cover. What happened?
Right. We heard some witnesses saying they heard three booms and then everybody started running. We know that the first call came into dispatch at 7:32 in the morning, and Galveston County Sheriff's deputies were there within a minute and a half. And the police had already entered the facility fairly quickly, so there was very quick police response, but it was chaotic at the scene. They said it was like a bloody mess. It was just lots of chaos.
Do we have any updates on the fatalities there at this time? We hear 9 students and 1 teacher. Is that correct?
That appears to be correct. That's as much as I know, too, yes.
Rob, you're there on the ground near the high school. What are you seeing right now? What are family members and students saying over there?
So I'm actually about 2 miles away from the high school at a sort of staging area that the various law enforcement agencies are using and have been using to provide information to families and parents. It's definitely calmed down a little bit since this morning when there were obviously a lot of people running in and out, finding out about their children and either, you know, departing to local hospitals or staying in there. But I have been talking to people who have been in one of the buildings for a few hours now, and they're telling me that there's been kind of an absence of information. They're not entirely sure what's happened to their loved one. And obviously in the absence of that information, you can't really help but speculate. So it's certainly, it's calmer than it was, but there's certainly obviously quite a lot of frustration, anxiety, and fear that you can among the people we've talked to.
And there are parents on the ground who still don't know what's going on with their children.
That's what I'm being told. Again, we are outside of the building and we are not allowed in, but I've been talking to people inside the building via text, and that's what they're telling me. So,
Matt, what about the suspect, Demetrios Pagortsis? What do we know about him?
So before his Facebook account, or it appears to be his Facebook account, was taken down, there was pictures of him. He had posted on April 30th a picture of a shirt that said Born to Kill, that he said was a custom-made shirt. Mm. He had a picture of it, what appeared to be like a flak jacket-type jacket that had Nazi insignias on it. Again, we're assuming it's a very unusual name, so it probably is him. Until very recently, we didn't have the name confirmed. So that's where we're going off of that for now.
But that's what law enforcement authorities are saying, that his name is Demetrios Pagortsis.
Yeah. And that's what I said. That is the Facebook account that we had seen earlier the day before his name was confirmed as the shooter.
And you said the Facebook page was taken down.
Mm-hmm. It was taken down about an hour or two after the initial incident.
We heard the sheriff saying this morning about they found suspicious material there, Matt, specifically explosive material, both off and on campus. Do we know anything more about that right now? Is he referring to actual bombs planted in the school?
Well, we know specifics. We know they're explosive devices. We don't know what specifically that means. We know that they are, like you said, on and off campus. The law enforcement specifically warned the public that if they see anything off of campus, to please call 911 immediately and let people know, let the law enforcement know so they can approach it. They do not have confirmation that they've detonated or even found all of the explosive devices that the shooter planted.
Can you tell us a little bit, and both of you, I think, can you give us sort of a little texture about Santa Fe, Texas? I mean, we know that Texas is an open carry state, that this high school participated, though, in the March for Our Lives walkouts a couple of months ago. What's Santa Fe like?
Santa Fe is just outside suburban Houston areas. It's in Galveston County. It's really closer towards the Bay. It's not quite rural, but it's somewhere in between suburban and rural. Not crazy densely populated. It's very conservative county, conservative area. There was some participants in the March for Our Lives, but we're not talking the whole student body walking out. We're talking 15, 20 at the most.
Well, we saw today that some reporters from the local TV station spoke to one man who showed up at the school right after that shooting. He had an American flag with him and a handgun on his hip saying, "Make America Great Again." Another person said he supports the Second Amendment, but it is not appropriate for that kind of talk, especially in light of what happened at the high school there. I know that there's been a lot of talk about the public fatigue with officials sending thoughts and prayers to victims. Are you hearing more besides those thoughts and prayers coming from politicians, local politicians?
There was, and I'm blanking on the names right now, I'm sorry. There was one politician who said that we've had decades of thoughts and prayers. We've had enough, a local Democratic politician. Like I said, sorry, I'm blanking on the names all suddenly. But it's breaking down on partisan lines as per usual. Ted Cruz is on his way to the scene. Governor Abbott is on his way to the scene.
Governor Abbott speaking right now, as a matter of fact,
yep.
From
there
over there. And I see Ted Cruz as well standing behind him.
Right.
We're going to have to wrap it up. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I said they're both strong Second Amendment supporters. So I think you'll see that, and you'll see people who are frustrated with that particular point of view.
As the investigation continues, of course, Matt Dempsey, the data editor from the Houston Chronicle, and also we had our other reporter on the scene there, Rob Dowen, on the scene in Santa Fe. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
The latest, of course, throughout the day on KCRW. Coming up on this program, 35 years later after the brutal murders of four, there are still questions about whether the man convicted, who is set to die, is actually innocent. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis, in for Madeline Brand. 35 years ago, a horrific and brutal murder sent shockwaves through Chino Hills. Four people were found dead at the home of Doug and Peggy Ryan, the husband and wife, their 10-year-old daughter, and a boy who lived down the street. He was sleeping over. The Ryan's 8-year-old son had also been attacked, but he survived. In all, the five victims had been stabbed or slashed dozens of times combined. Evidence from the home suggested more than one killer, a trio perhaps of white men, and witness testimony, including testimony from the boy who survived, backed up that theory. But the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department came to another conclusion. They charged a sole black man, a man named Kevin Cooper, with the four murders. A jury convicted him, and a judge sentenced him to death. And Cooper there awaits his execution. Now, more than three decades later, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof writes that he has never come across a case in America as outrageous as Cooper's. And Nick Kristof joins me right now. Hi, Nick.
Hi, good to be with you.
You bet. Why is this case particularly egregious to you?
For a few reasons. I mean, one is that there is so much evidence that he was framed by the authorities, essentially trying to solve a case that was so sensational, that involved so much political pressure on the authorities. And secondly, I'd say because there are so many prominent, smart people who have stepped up and said he was framed. Federal judges have said this quite explicitly. William Fletcher, in particular, wrote a 100-page judicial opinion on this. And this is also an unusual case in that we not only have strong evidence of the innocence of the man who was on death row, but we also have evidence that points to one particular named individual. And what I find most frustrating is that the California authorities have not allowed DNA testing in this case to find out. So who did it? Advanced DNA testing. I should say there was some much earlier DNA testing.
There was some DNA testing, blood testing, correct?
Yeah, there was some blood testing on a shirt that was apparently worn by the murderer, and it found that Kevin Cooper's blood was on this shirt in 2002, and that initially seemed to suggest, okay, well, he must have done it. But then they tested again, and they found a blood preservative was in that blood. It's a blood preservative. When you put blood in a test tube, there's that little kind of pill at the bottom. That's the preservative EDTA. So that indicated that the blood came not from Kevin Cooper himself, but from a test tube that had been drawn from him.
That perhaps that blood had been planted on that shirt.
Exactly.
How did Kevin Cooper, Nick, even come to be associated with these murders?
So what happened was that the authorities were, you know, frantically investigating this. Initially, they were looking for three white men. And then they discovered that Kevin Cooper had escaped from Chino prison nearby and had holed up in an empty house only 125 yards from the Ryan house. And so I think they, you know, legitimately thought that here's this career criminal. He's a desperate escape felon. He must have committed the murders. But
some of the evidence exhibited or that was in that house at the time showed that perhaps there were multiple attackers. Initially, the coroner's office was investigating the murders under that theory, that it was three white perpetrators who committed the crimes. Why was that theory abandoned?
Well, simply because they couldn't find those three white people, and they did find this young black man with a long criminal history.
So they wanted immediate closure on this case.
Yeah, and in fairness to them, I think they genuinely really did think that Cooper I think they genuinely did think that Cooper had done it. And look, the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Office was kind of a cowboy sheriff's office at that time. The sheriff, Floyd Tidwell, was later caught for stealing more than 500 guns from the evidence room. One of the lab technicians in the office who found key evidence against Kevin Cooper, he was later fired for stealing heroin from the evidence room. And there's also some evidence that a detective had, in other cases, planted evidence against suspects a suspect who later turned out to be completely innocent.
You mentioned the shirts with the blood and the EDTA on it, right? The preservative. But there's also the evidence of the station wagon, the family station wagon that was found in Long Beach with blood on three seats, not on one seat, but on three seats.
That's right. So the prosecution theory of the motive was that Kevin Cooper needed to steal the station wagon. The problem with that theory was, A, that the keys were in the car, so he didn't need to go into the house to steal the car, and B, that he hitchhiked down to Tijuana and crossed the border into Tijuana the day after the killings, the same day the murders were discovered. But the station wagon was seen shortly after the killings by two different groups of people with three white people in it. It was seen the next day by a woman with three white people in it, and she jotted down the license plate number because it was driving so erratically, almost got into an accident with her. And then 6 days after the killings, when Cooper is long gone, it suddenly shows up in Long Beach near the home of the stepmother of this man who is this white man who has been implicated in the case.
You spoke to Cooper about all of this, right? You went and visited him in prison on death row.
I did.
What does he say about all this?
Well, he actually at the end of my column on this, there is a audio clip that I hope people will listen to. He says he's absolutely innocent. He says that I asked him who he blamed for this. Does he blame the jury? Does he blame the prosecutors? He blames himself for having escaped from Chino prison and kind of getting himself into the whole mess to begin with. He's also very much focused on kind of the structural injustices in the criminal system and the degree to which low-income folks who can't afford good lawyers end up disproportionately being the target of these things.
You also spoke with a man named Lee, who as you said, could be implicated in this, who has denied any culpability in this, correct?
That's correct. Lee had committed a murder of a 17-year-old girl. He was released from prison less than a year before these killings. His girlfriend reported him to the authorities as somebody who she believed had been involved. She said he came home late on the night of the killings in a vehicle that resembled the Ryan station wagon, wearing bloody coveralls, and she handed the coveralls over to the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Office, and they threw them away.
They threw them away?
They threw them away. They did not test them.
Did they say why they threw them away?
Basically because they were focused on Kevin Cooper.
But, I mean, they were given evidence of bloody coveralls, right? Like if a police department or any law enforcement apparatus had received something like that, you wouldn't throw something like that away.
No, you wouldn't. And you certainly wouldn't do that without testing. Likewise, one of the problems for the prosecution was that they found two bloody shirts that seemed to be associated with the killers. And so they kept one, and indeed it had the victim's blood on it, but they threw the other one away, or at least they've said they can't find it.
Well, there are things that can be done to clarify what happened, right? We have now in our possession, you know, in the 21st century, we have advanced DNA that could perhaps clear all of this up.
That's right, and that's what the defense asked for. That's what my column asked for. And so, I'm not saying free this guy right away. I'm just saying let's find out what happened. And so,
and you ask that of Governor Jerry Brown and of the now who used to be at the helm of the Attorney General's office, Kamala Harris, now U.S. Senator. What have they said?
Very recently, just today, so Kamala Harris called me and put out a statement saying, indeed, she now calls on California and on Governor Brown to allow the DNA testing in Kevin Cooper's case. And I hope that Governor Brown will do so.
We reached out to the governor's office, Nick, and here's what his spokesperson had to say from Sacramento. As you know, Mr. Kristof is a columnist in the opinion section of the New York Times, not a news reporter. Think the distinction between news reporting and advocacy work is important for your listeners to understand if you intend to run a news piece based on a column written by an individual who's been advocating for Mr. Cooper for quite some time.
Well,
that's the first time you're hearing this, right?
Yeah, that's the first time I'm hearing it, and I'm happy to have them push back and explain why they don't want to allow DNA testing that might resolve this question. So if they think I'm wrong, then sure, then by all means allow that.
Here's what else they say. They say, we received a clemency petition from Mr. Cooper, and it remains under review. So they have not squashed anything. And that a request for clemency is a serious matter, and applications are thoroughly and diligently reviewed. We relayed that much to the columnist, but a decision was made to bury that fact.
In fact, I reported that fact. I'm skeptical of this. They received the clemency petition more than 2 years ago, and they have not done anything since then. And look, a starting point would be, if you're going to investigate whether to give clemency, a starting point would be to do DNA testing.
Nicholas Kristof, columnist for The New York Times. Nick, thank you so much.
Sure. Good to be with you.
Well, coming up, a new documentary that focuses on the life of a filmmaker who was the right-hand man to Stanley Kubrick.
To have the opportunity, like Leon did, and to spend all that time with him, I think it's enticing. It's beautiful.
A documentary about Stanley Kubrick's right-hand man. That's next on Press Play.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
You wantonly caused me injury and dishonor in such a manner and to such an extent as to which no gentleman can willingly suffer without demanding satisfaction.
Actor Leon Vitali as Lord Bullingdon opposite Ryan O'Neill in Stanley Kubrick's classic 1975 film Barry Lyndon. A plum role for a young actor. But after watching the master director at work on set, Leon Vitali decided to pursue another role. He would work with Stanley Kubrick in any way possible behind the camera. He would leave acting behind and become Kubrick's right-hand man, his casting director, his personal assistant, his acting coach, archivist, marketing director, pretty much everything. He would devote his life to the work for more than two decades until Kubrick's death in 1999. Leon Vitali is the subject of a new documentary. It's called Filmworker, and it's directed by Tony Zierra. He and Leon Vitali join me now. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Mm.
Tony, how did you first learn about Leon?
Through research, I was working on a documentary about Kubrick's creative process, and I knew that Leon was one of the closest people that spent countless hours with Kubrick talking about creativity as far as like when it came to the work itself. Mm-hmm. So I was really keen on like finding him, and I did. And it's so unusual to see someone that was an actor that became an assistant that with that level of knowledge when it comes to film. And Leon just took over my psyche.
Wow.
But Leon, that must sound a little strange to you because you were always on the sidelines. You weren't in the spotlight.
No, I wasn't. But I guess when I was an actor, I never sort of felt as it was, you know, something that was made me stand out or even want to stand out because you're part of an ensemble when all's said and done. So I never really ever thought of myself in that way anyway. It was the work that was most important to me.
The title of this documentary is Filmworker, and that's what you call yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For lack of another word.
Another word, yeah.
But can you describe what you did? What was a typical day like for you working for Stanley Kubrick?
Well, I think, you know, what film work shows you is that the variation, the variables that were in play at any one time. I mean, you know, it was very rarely I could spend all day on one particular task, as Stanley used to say, I have a task for you, because there was always other stuff interloping. And so I could have been working in the laboratory for a morning or even a whole day. And then when...
And what would happen in the lab?
Well, we worked with color timing and, you know, actually getting a look to the print that Stanley wanted it to look
like. So
like
color correcting.
Color correcting and density and contrast and all those things. And then take it back to Stanley for him to look at and critique, which he often had quite a lot of critiques. But also, I could be talking to Japan about the release of, say, Full Metal Jacket. You kind of had to just say, okay, that's that. Now I'm dealing with this, and I'm dealing with that. And it just moved all the time. It was very, what do you call it, amorphous? You know, it just glided one thing into the other.
It sounds like it was your entire life.
It was, yeah.
Tony, this is unusual, right, for a director to do all this stuff in-house, if you will, or rely on one person to do all these different things?
Yes, but that is what intrigued me about the project, too, is because I felt like I had Stanley Kubrick, who is, you know, the ultimate, you know, taskmaster slash amazing cinema that I love. And then Leon Vitali was also an artist that represented that amazing devotion. And so to have them both on a project together and then to sit with Leon and just go through all the years that he, you know, all the work that he did with Kubrick. I mean, even Leon himself, sometimes we would pull out stuff from his amazing archive at home. And he would be like, he would always say, oh, wow, I forgot that I did this and I did that. There was just so much stuff that he really got to work with.
Let's talk about The Shining and your role in The Shining. Mm-hmm. You were involved in casting that movie.
Yeah. In fact, it was really the first task that Stanley gave me to do. He asked me if I was interested. Well, I have to go back a little bit when I told him that I was so interested in the actual process of filmmaking and what have you. And he said to me, he said, well, if you're serious, you know, do something about it. And if you do something about it, let me know. And so that's what I did. And then he kind of said, well, how would you feel about going to the States to look for the little boy to play in The Shining, to play Danny in The Shining? And great, of course, whatever, you know. And that for me was a huge experience. I saw over 4,000 children in 6 months while I was there. And then at the same time, he sent me around taking photographs of interiors of hotels, you know, whether it was kitchen, staff quarters, ballrooms, whatever. And so it was just kind of, I didn't realize, but it was becoming more and more and more.
What you were doing. So yeah. You found the actor who played Danny.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
little kid. And when you said to Stanley Kubrick, this is the one.
Mm-hmm.
And he immediately agreed, or what was
Yeah, it was strange.
How did you know, if this was your first job with him, how did you know what he wanted?
Well, because I was an actor, and I kind of, you recognize qualities, you know.
Tony, I'm scared. Remember what Mr. Halloran said? It's just like pictures in a book, Candy. It isn't real.
Tony, can you assess for us the importance of Leon's role in that film and also his other movies, Kubrick's other movies? Would they have looked the same way? Would they have been the same movies without Leon?
I don't think so, because, you know, of course, and Leon said that to me several times, Kubrick would have found a way to do what he wanted to do, but I think Stanley was very smart to pick the right person to assign all these jobs to, because you really want someone that understands, that has that sensibility, knowing what a good actor, look at color or to do color correction or sound. And I think Leon really brought so much to the table. And that's really, I think that exists also in Hollywood to a certain degree. I think Leon is an amazing like example of it. But there are a lot of amazing creative people that we don't hear about because of the details in film, you know?
Absolutely.
But it is a group effort. It's not just one person.
And
that's the point of the film, really.
But Leon, this was all-consuming for you. This was often you would work, or you say in this documentary, there were periods where you'd work 36 hours at a stretch.
Yeah. No exaggeration either. Yeah.
And it must have taken a toll on you physically as well as mentally.
You mean the banging my head against the wall? Yeah. Well, yeah, of course it does. But you don't think about that. You don't think about it. I mean, if you're really into something, you know, you don't think about, oh, is this going to make me ill? Or is the future going to be dire because I've overdone it? These things do take people over, and you don't think about the consequences of health and stuff like that.
What were the consequences?
Oh, I did become ill. I mean, but I wouldn't say it was anything more than probably me just misjudging myself. But
well, I wanted to say something that it was interesting that with Leon, it was very hard for him to always admit to me on camera, but I did get these stories from other people, including his children, you know, about the fact that, I mean, he slept on the doormat, you know, so he doesn't get too comfortable so he could go back to to Kubrick in the morning and while they were doing Full Metal Jacket. It's he just gets so consumed, and we do talk about it. It's almost like it is a creative addiction in a sense that we just we love it so much. And
but was this because you pushed yourself, or was he pushing you, or was it both?
It's a symbiosis. I mean, I served him because he served his movies. I mean, it was all consuming for him. And there are millions of little things that have to be done to make it, you know, a positive experience if you're the filmmaker. But you need people who actually help you get there. And for me, it wasn't a question of, you know, brownie points or anything like that. It was, God, this needs to be done. There's a deadline. And if you miss it, maybe you lost days, if not hours, you know. And I kind of, my mum was a nurse all her life, you know. And so there is that sort of streak where you don't really put yourself first. And I'm not saying that in any kind of martyr way. You just, what it is you're doing is the important thing to you. And so you want to fulfill it to the best of your ability. And you can't really evade it. You can't miss it. You can't skip it. You can't, it becomes, it's true, it becomes an obsession. It's just to get it right and get it done. So there's no one kind of way of thinking about it. Mm. I don't think it's a combination of all these things, upbringing, you know, every experience.
I mean, your siblings are interviewed in the movie and they seem to make a link between your and their authoritarian father,
right,
and Kubrick,
right.
and the relationship parallel there.
Right. Well, I've got to say, you know, they say if it doesn't kill you, you know, it makes you stronger. My dad was so volatile, you just never knew which way he was going to go, and it could be anything. A door left open that would absolutely inflame him, you know? And so you learn to kind of circumvent all these incredible, irrational emotions. And what it taught me was that as you grow up, and as I've grown up and became an adult, was that it doesn't always apply to you. It's just so often someone venting about something else. And with Stanley, he was such a transparent kind of person, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but you could see where it was coming from. You know, you could see if it was just a frustration.
So you wouldn't take it personally?
No.
But you do see.
But when he targeted me, I took it personally, you bet.
So he would explode on you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he could do that. Really, he could. But, you know, I also could argue my point back. He wasn't a tyrant in that way, you know.
I didn't know this too, because I showed the film to Christiana Kubrick and at their house, and she said something to me in the end that really kind of made me go, "Oh." She said she really never understood why Leon like chose to leave acting, which is much more comfortable than being an assistant and doing all that work. And she also said that also Stanley didn't know, like he was surprised about that too. But I think there's something very special about Leon that it's, again, it's the creativity. The more creativity you give him, but then just that's my view of it, the more he'll chase it. And
you never told me that Stanley wondered why.
I wanted to surprise you on the radio. Yeah, but yeah, he was surprised. He was surprised. Well, he didn't know why. Right. You know, but he was happy. You know?
So he never asked you over the decades you worked with him?
Not why, no. But sometimes we'd be sitting watching, you know, them put a new lighting set up, you know, and we'd be sitting there, and he'd turn to me and he'd say, "Filmmaking's really exciting, isn't it, Leon?" You know, I mean, it became so run of the mill and ordinary, and oh, God, what are we waiting for now? So, you know, it was just, what can I say? It's like working on a farm, and you know, you're trying to corral all those sheep or whatever it is and get them into the same place at the same time, you know.
Except this farm, in this case, yeah, happened to be the work of probably the greatest film director,
yeah, I know.
American
Wrong analogy,
film director,
really, yeah.
of ever.
It is quite a privilege to kind of be in that world, because it is a world. I mean, to have that opportunity like Leon did and to spend all that time with him, I think it's enticing. It's beautiful.
So no regrets?
No, my God.
You sound like me now in the movie.
I'd be in 24-hour therapy if I had any regrets about that. I mean, this feels a little bit like a big public therapy session. I have to say, when I saw the film and I went for the first Q&A and I thought, oh, my God, this is like talking to 1,000 therapists all at the same time. But no, I've got no regrets whatsoever. And the things I've learned... It's curiosity that's fueled. That's what's beautiful, really.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure.
Leon Vitale, the subject of Tony Sierra's new documentary. It's called Film Worker. It opens tonight at the New Art Theater in Los Angeles. And Leon and Tony will be there for another therapy session, a Q&A. They'll be there tonight.
And Madeline will be back here in this chair on Monday. Coming up on this show, Friday Movie Reviews. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiatakis in for Madeline Brand. Another day, another dollar for Marvel. And on this Friday, it's time for movie reviews. And there is another Marvel movie out this week. And film critics Dave White and Alonzo Duraldi are here to tell us what to see over the weekend. Both review for The Wrap and host the Linoleum Knife podcast. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hey there.
All right. First up, the Marvel superhero movie that I mentioned. Ryan Reynolds returns in Deadpool 2 as the crime-fighting Wade Wilson. Let's hear a clip.
Wade, you have a good heart. With training, you can be X-Men.
I am not X-Men material at all. First off, I'm not even a virgin.
All right, so there you go. I'm not even a virgin. We'll get to not even a virgin in just a minute. But Alonzo, I'll start with you. Tell us about Deadpool. And for people who haven't seen the first one, what kind of superhero is he?
Well, you know, this is a very R-rated superhero movie. Fox kind of has cornered the market on this between the first Deadpool and Logan last year. Deadpool is also very snarky, I guess, is the word to use. He breaks the fourth wall all the time. He is cognizant of the fact that superhero movies exist, that superhero comics exist. He drops a lot of very meta references to other X-Men movies and to other Ryan Reynolds movies, for that matter. Plus, like, the violence is super crazy, over-the-top, cartoonish violence, but bloody in a way that, say, your Avengers movies are not.
Like Matrix-like violence, though, right? Where it freezes in midair and things like that.
Super elaborate, but also, you know, rather explicit in a lot of ways. But a lot of fun. And Deadpool 2, like its predecessor, is a ton of fun. What it isn't is it doesn't one-up the first one at all, which I think a comedy sequel sort of has to do. Otherwise, you're just kind of telling the same joke twice, but more elaborately. And I kind of feel like that's what's happening here. And while if you just want to hear that joke again, you're going to love it. If you liked the first Deadpool, they are serving you another plate of it. But if you didn't like the first Deadpool, this one's not going to win you over. And if you were hoping that the Deadpool series was going to, you know, move up the food chain a little and try something a little different and you know, like I said, up the ante, they don't really do that.
Does it compare, Dave?
Listen, yesterday on Twitter, someone I read said that Deadpool is Minions for adults. Mm. And so when you have the Minions in front of you, do you really want them to be anything but Minions and yelling banana again and again? The answer is no, you don't. I think the Deadpool movies they're meaningless, obviously, but they are also sort of a nice little break from the occasional self-seriousness of the other Marvel superheroes. I know that we had a sort of lighthearted introduction to the new Spider-Man whenever that one came out. They all blur now for me, but this is well into we are mocking ourselves and we're just going to keep doing that. Your tolerance, I think, for this sort of thing is going to depend on how much you can deal with Ryan Reynolds and his constant levels of sarcasm.
Well, he talks
There's
about
nothing real coming out of his mouth.
In the
ever.
Clip we just heard, first off, I'm not even a virgin, right? And didn't he say in an interview not too long ago that he wanted to be like the first pansexual
Yeah,
superhero.
You know, and here's the thing. On the one hand, like Scott Mendelson at Forbes, I think really nailed it where he said, look, either make these characters LGBT and risk opening them in you know, China or whatever, or don't. But stop giving these interviews where you tell us things about the character that aren't in the actual work. I will give Deadpool 2 credit for giving us an actual canonical, unquestionably queer superhero, and that is Negatonic Teenage Warhead has a girlfriend in this one.
Has a girlfriend.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome to the 21st century.
Exactly.
And next in Deadpool 3, let's have him put his money where his mouth is. I want explicit sex with Ant-Man.
Okay.
From Deadpool. I want those two to hook up. That's it. Make it so. Look, if you're going to talk all this stuff in your interviews, do it.
Yeah, Deadpool is already grabbing Colossus's rear end, so he's halfway there. Let's just, you know, no more half measures, Marvel.
Yeah.
I really don't know how to switch gears, but I'm going to try. A film called First Reformed. This is starring Ethan Hawke as a troubled pastor of a small church in New York. Here's a clip.
I've decided to keep a journal to set down all my thoughts and the simple events of my day. I will keep this diary for 1 year, and at the end of that time, it will be destroyed.
Now, this is basically a reworking of the French classic Diary of a Country Priest. What is the plot, Dave?
It references Diary of a Country Priest a lot. It also references Ingmar Bergman's Winter Light and John Huston's Wise Blood, because Paul Schrader very famously wrote a book on the idea of transcendence in the films of Robert Bresson, who directed Diary of a Country Priest, and Ozu.
And Dreyer.
And yes. And so this film is about a minister, unnamed denomination. He is the pastor of what is essentially a historical tourist church with almost no congregation. And so, very much like Diary of a Country Priest, his sermons fall on no ears,
yeah,
pretty much,
virtually,
most of the
yeah.
time. People in his life don't take him seriously. The pastor of the megachurch that sort of sponsors this church speaks to him in a rather condescending way, as does pretty much everyone else in the film. Again, very much like Diary of a Country Priest. There are shots in this movie that directly echo Diary of a Country Priest. If you've never seen it, go watch them side by side and you'll be shocked. But what this film really is about a man whose faith is not one that he came by easily. And it's one that is now going to be challenged in a way that will shock a lot of audience members, I think, if they're used to Christianity being presented in films in a very specific way. And with the recent wave of Christian cinema that we've been experiencing, the audience for those films is used to it being presented in a very specific,
like heaven is for real,
very triumphant sort of way. And this is a film about failure and about doubt and about impossible choices. It is essentially a rebuke, a very solemn rebuke to the evangelical cinema of, you know, 2018.
And yeah, Paul Schrader has gone, like, in different directions in many
he's,
ways.
You know,
right?
He's been a dyed-in-the-wool Calvinist all of his life, and I think, you know, he is a faith-based filmmaker and always has been, but in a very different way than, say, the people behind the God's Not Dead movies. And so this is a very, this is the Schraderiest Schrader movie, because he's bringing in his love of Bresson. He is giving us a character who's very much a descendant of Travis Bickle and,
yes,
you know, Julian Kay from American Gigolo and the other sort of anti-heroes that he's created over the years. Even in the casting of, as the pastor of the megachurch, the comedian Cedric the Entertainer, Schrader, back in the 70s in his movie Blue Collar, was the first person to give Richard Pryor a dramatic role in a film. So he's even calling back on his own sort of, you know, casting sense of, hey, let's take this guy who's known very much for one thing and put him in something completely different and let him shine there. And Cedric the Entertainer is really good in this.
Yes.
So there is, he's bringing a lot of his own work and ideas and philosophies to the table. And it is, as a result, you know, the best thing he's made in quite a while.
Schraderiest.
Right.
Yes.
Schrader. I love that word. I just wrote it down over here.
It's an excellent film. And also somewhat troubling.
Let's talk about Book Club, a comedy about four women in their 70s whose lives are, they're turned upside down when they discover the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy. Here's a clip.
This book made me realize that it's been quite a while since we, you know.
As in As in weeks?
Like maybe six.
6 weeks?
Months.
Oh my God, I thought you guys were like rabbits.
We are. If rabbits took a ton of Benadryl and made a chastity pack.
Jane Fonda and Mary Steenburgen, those are the stars. It also stars Diane Keaton, Candace Bergen. Candace Bergen, of course, coming back as Murphy Brown this year. So she's had a bit of an encore presentation, if you will. So what do you think? Does the film live up to the talent in it, Dave?
First, I want to thank you for playing one of the clips where one of the few jokes in the film
that lands.
I know where this is going.
This is such a weird movie. Can I say that I'm happy this film exists without actually really liking it very much? Because I believe in so much of what is happening in this movie. These are four actresses who come together for this movie that doesn't really have much for them to do, but they're so good. And so good at communicating the idea that they are friends who love each other and have been friends for decades. And you believe that by the end of the movie, that when it's over, you might think to yourself, well, that was about a lot of nothing, except I love those women.
Together in the same room.
And
yeah.
They each get a moment, you know, to sort of do what they do best as actors. They each get a moment to shine. They carry this material because it refuses to carry them.
Yeah, the material doesn't deserve them, but, you know, they're so great, and if you want to see them, and you want to see them be the center stage of a film, which doesn't happen all that often, then you're going to just have to deal with every awful thing that comes out of everyone's mouths, and the terrible Photoshop and green screen, and all the other really clumsy things that this movie has to offer. You know, it's like when you see Alfre Woodard being in a Tyler Perry movie and you think, really? This is what Alfre Woodard's getting offered? And, you know, these four women should be running the table. And instead, they're doing this ridiculous, horrible, hacky comedy about, you know, four women of a certain age reading one of the worst novels ever written and having their libidos reawakened.
And that's the confusing part. The very premise is weird because You learn that they've had this book club since the 1970s, and that Jane Fonda's character always makes them read really racy stuff. Like in the 70s, she made them read Erica Jong's Fear of Flying. Mm. But now she's got them reading Twilight fan fiction, and somehow they're all shocked instead of rolling their eyes. It's just a bizarre thing. Now, fortunately, the book is not primary here. The book is barely mentioned after the initial, we're all going to read this naughty book together. It then becomes about their lives. Unfortunately, the movie doesn't make their lives especially interesting. It is up to the actors to take this lightweight nothing and turn it into
something. The material doesn't deserve them.
No. Yeah. And you could have easily made this Sex and the City 3. I mean, it literally boils down to Jane Fonda is the Samantha, Candace Bergen is the Miranda. She's even a judge.
Yeah.
Mary Steenburgen is the Charlotte, and Diane Keaton narrates, so that makes her the Carrie.
If to make a future Sex and the City 3 starring these four, then I will
oh,
watch that.
Oh, yeah, let them
step
in.
Sex and the City 2 was so god-awful.
What about the Golden Girls?
I'm sure there's probably an astrological chart for them, too.
Yeah. So Jane Fonda would be the Blanche Devereaux, right?
Think so, yes. I think you're on it.
All right. I don't know which ones, who among you, who would be Rose or Dorothy's Burnett?
Oh, this is a House of All B. Arthurs.
Yeah.
All right. Dave White, Alonzo Duraldi, both review for The Wrap and host the Linoleum Knife Podcast. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And that's Press Play. Our show is directed by the illustrious Sarah Sweeney. Our producers include Amy Ta, Christian Bordahl, Michelle Aloy, Gina Pollack, Yael Evan Orr, and Linda Wang. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer. Mario Save is our engineer. Alexandra Trigvadotar is our intern. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Madeline Brand is back on Monday. Have a great weekend.